Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words with Bruce Duff. This episode is going to be special because Bruce is actually the first person to ever email me his resume before doing the show, and I gotta tell you, it's smart. I don't know if we're going to be able to cover maybe two-fifths of what he said in his resume in this short format, but I'll attempt to do it justice. Next week, we've got Mark and Eric from Word is Bond Management, who manage way too many different bands. They will be on the show, a phone interview. The following week is kind of cool because Dan Suriff, who manages Black Veil Brides, and he actually works for Mercenary Management, which reps Zach Wilde. He's going to be on the show, so we're going to bring some metal to Waldman's Words and a little bit of talk about that, because I believe Black Veil Brides is trying to do what Motley Crue did in the 80s, so I don't know if they are doing it, but a lot of people seem to agree. Blake Cordero, who works at the Catalyst Publicity Company with Jenna Pell, who I just got to say is one of the sweetest people in PR. There's a lot of people that aren't as sweet as her, and she is awesome. And Blake works for that company, and in addition, he manages this band called Nominee, who I don't know if you recently caught them on tour with Sundressed, who put out probably one of my favorite records of the year. Nominee's great. Blake's great. And then the following week, we've got Morgan from Rocketown, the venue, and he also manages a bunch of bands. So Morgan Carney will be on the show. I'd say 2017, as I've said multiple times, has been a really good year for us to focus on the behind-the-scenes people. When I started this show, I was just unsure of, I guess, a specific focus, and I got to interview a lot of people in bands, which is awesome. I mean, I'm still totally down for that, but I really, really tried to make this as informative as possible so that people can learn something from the people who really make things happen, like Bruce Duff. So, as always, stick around every single Tuesday night, 5 o'clock on the West Coast where we are right now, where I am wearing sandals and sweatpants to my fancy radio show, and 8 o'clock on the East Coast where it is getting a little bit nicer, which is really nice to hear. We're going to be talking with Bruce about his plethora of industry tales, and just want to give a special shout out to Knitting Factory Records, the Knitting Factory venue franchise, and Knitting Factory Management, because when I first moved to LA, it was definitely a home away from home, the one in the Hollywood and Highland area. I think I played in all three rooms with several bands. And in New York City, obviously there's the one in Brooklyn right now, but the one in Manhattan is probably top five venue I've ever played. So respect to that. Stick around. Hello. Welcome back to Waldman's Words. Hopefully you enjoy those wonderful commercials. To my left, we've got Bruce Duff.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Wednesday morning in beautiful California.
And your commute was really short because we met for the first time, I'd say, maybe a half a mile away from here.
Yeah, my office is over Weddington and Lancashire.
Wow. The newly christened Arts District of North Hollywood.
Yeah, it's gone through some changes in the last few years.
Yeah, it used to be kind of like the Gun District. And now, like, I feel that when I walk around that area, a lot safer. I actually moved to North Hollywood after signing a lease with my then girlfriend, and it didn't work out. So, fun fact.
Okay.
Sick transition, right? So, yeah. We met because of the 210s. I manage Kim Shattuck of the Muffs, who you've had a relationship with probably since about the 80s or 90s, I assume.
Well, yeah, when they first got together, they did a record for Bill Bartell's label, Gassatanka. And I'm pretty sure they did, or he produced them in something. And then they did something for Long Gone John, Sympathy for the Record Industry. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to get him. I was working at Triple X Records at the time, so we wanted to get him for a long form. It did not end up working out. I think actually that's when they went to Sympathy.
Nice. Well, I was out with Kim last night. We went to a show at the Echo Plexus band called The Paranoids. And by the time this airs, it won't be last night, but it doesn't matter. And it was amazing. The bartender just was like,
"You're Kim."
Pointed at her and handed us bottles of water that were probably the most delicious bottles of water.
She's a pop star.
She's amazing. She's such a pleasure to work with. But speaking of work with, I met you because you managed the 210s, a great two-piece band, and Kim wanted to work with them, and then we had lunch at the Federal, and you knew a lot, so I figured I'd have you on the show, so thank you for doing that.
No problem. I hope I haven't forgotten it all.
I mean, you might have. It's okay. And if you have, then this might be the first Alzheimer's edition of Waldman's Words, so hopefully...
Very possible.
You know, it's cool. So you're from the great state of California, correct?
Yeah, I grew up in the Inland Empire in Riverside, went to school there, and then moved here after college in the very, very late 70s, tail end.
So what was the Riverside music scene like? Because I can't think of... aren't like Voodoo Glow Skulls from Riverside?
Well, yeah, after I left, there was a kind of an Inland Empire ska boom. Mm-hmm. Say Ferris came out of that, Voodoo Glow Skulls. There's a lot of bands. In a way, although it was Orange County, you know, Gwen Stefani and all them came out of that as well.
Well, Say Ferris is main stage Warp this year, which is pretty
back
wild.
Back in action. Her sister's been cutting my hair for a decade.
Oh, really?
Actually, how my wife was... having her hair done by her, and she goes, "Hey, my hairdresser's sister has this band. You should look at them." I'm like, "Okay," and that was Say Ferris. It was great, and one, you know, when you're at a label or in a management or anything like that, there's always as many tales of failure that you can look forward to, and that was a big one because
there's more of those.
Well, because we wanted to sign them, and they were down and looking at the contracts, and everything was great, and the deal breaker was that they wanted to do an EP, and it was right in the middle of the CD boom, and we kind of made a company policy, no more EPs, full albums, and that was a deal breaker. And so their EP came out on Sony.
Epic, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it was a top 40 record.
Which is kind of amazing. I remember they were in the movie 10 Things I Hate About You. They had their time for quite a while, and I think they kind of had some acrimonious split with their members, like a lot of bands do, but she's back on Warped.
Well, yeah, and actually, speaking of my hairdresser, when I was in there...
Yeah, keep talking about your hairdresser.
Yeah, well, you know how it is. So I was actually there in a ska t-shirt from the selector, and she goes, "Oh, you got to hear the new Say Ferris," and she put it on. So I've actually heard the whole record, and it's true to form, man. It's pretty good.
They had the whole ska swing thing down, and she could sing, man.
I've used her on some records I've produced, and yeah, she's great.
Yeah, she does a lot of session work.
Very fast learner. You know, you don't have to do a lot of takes with Monique. She's pretty much top of the line professional.
Well, that's good to hear. A lot of people sometimes promise the world and deliver a small planet.
No, she's great.
So, I guess, tell me more about, I guess, the music scene, and how did you get involved? Because honestly, you're such a hyphen between being a manager, a producer. You have your own show, much like this. You play in bands. Like, what was kind of your gateway drug to pursuing this as your livelihood?
Well, you know, livelihood came a little later, but I got into it. I just had guitar fever. I mean, really, really young. I know so many guys got into bands just because it was almost like the alternative to being a jock in high school, a cool thing to do. That you could get a girl, you know, that kind of thing. But I was into it so early, I wasn't even interested in girls yet. It's kind of embarrassing to say.
That's not embarrassing.
Quick story was I went to a friend of mine's birthday party. His name was Eric Chow. He ended up being a Major League Baseball player for the Padres.
Oh, wow.
And at the time, he was having his 10th birthday party, and a bunch of us kids that had known him since kindergarten, that's how ridiculous the story is, we went to his bedroom after the party, and he pulls out a guitar and amp. Primitive stuff, and he sat down and started playing it, and it blew my head off. He could play like a professional musician, and he was just turning 10, and I was like, I gotta do this, because man, get a guitar and I'll hook you up with my teacher and we'll start a band. And I played with him through high school till we were 18.
And then he went small time major league.
No, he pitched a
no, I'm being sarcastic. If you're a major league player,
yeah,
that's...
he was big time.
Yeah, well, I was with my friends in eighth grade, and we had a band name set before we even could play instruments. We were called Minty Fresh.
Good.
And we went and to actually, Fish might know this place, Freeport, Long Island, to a pawn shop and rented guitars and rented everything. And we said, you know what, we're all going to take lessons and we're going to be a successful band. And none of them stuck with it, and I did. So that's the story of Minty Fresh behind the music. The episode is over. So I guess you play guitar, you had guitar fever from the time you were about 10 years old, and did you start a band when you were, like, preteen?
Yeah, my first show we played at junior high. I was going to be the bass player, but I didn't have a bass yet, so I played. We had two guitars and drums, so we were sort of inventing the cramps back in junior high. Playing covers. And we're terrible, but you know, we stuck with it. And by the time we got to high school, we were
not everyone we can be handsome.
In high
men.
School, we were the popular band in town. So
that's awesome.
We were pretty good.
Did you do any touring?
No, not at that point. But after that, when I went to college, I actually wrote a ballet, a rock ballet.
So, what?
Yeah, cause I felt rock operas had been overdone. So it was this thing called the Magnolia Ballet. It was about there was this phenomenon in Riverside where kids with nothing to do would just soup up their cars and cruise the street. And there were two end points that they would hang out in. And
like American Graffiti?
Yeah, but even more pathetic. And smoke pot and drink, and that was kind of it. So I had like a 45-minute ballet about it. And sort of as a prequel to being in the management end, I figured out how to get the school to pay for it and finance the whole thing and put it on.
So what was it called?
The Magnolia Ballet. That was the big cruising street in Riverside.
I mean.
So anyways, that sort of morphed into a theater rock band called Numbers, which was my first foray into trying to get a record deal and all that kind of stuff. And we were very much a Tubes ripoff by the time we developed into something that was playing in Los Angeles.
Everyone's a ripoff of something.
Yeah. I mean, we admit it. We thought the Tubes were incredible. And, if you saw them back in the A&M days before they signed with Capitol Records and actually had hits, they were just an unbeatable live show, group. I mean, the musicianship is incredible. The staging and the makeup and the, you know, effects, just the whole production was beyond belief.
Where'd they play in L.A.?
Oh, they'd play everywhere. They played the Shrine, the Whiskey. Yeah, they were always touring through Southern California. They were based originally in Phoenix, but they settled in San Francisco. So San Francisco was the
pre-gentrification place. San Francisco, probably.
So trying for sure.
Yeah, it's so pricey now. So I guess what led you, because obviously if you put on a ballet, then you know a lot of the behind-the-scenes work that are painstaking. How did you, I guess, transition to management? Did you work for the Knitting Factory venue before? Or like, because your history is kind of convoluted to me, so I just want to...
I was at Triple X Records, which I worked at through...
Name some bands. I mean, I know the label, but...
Jane's Addiction, The Adolescents, Pygmy Love Circus, Celebrity Skin, Motorcycle Boy. A lot of sort of... California, Hollywood-based stuff. Not entirely, but a lot of it. We're one of the first labels to get in on the early burgeoning Brooklyn scene. We had a band called Spongehead. We had Bark Market, from which mega producer Dave Sardi came out of.
Dave Sardi, right?
Yeah, they signed with American almost immediately. Got plucked away from us. But
were you A&R at the
no,
label?
No, it was a weird thing. Before that, I worked as a publicist at an independent publicity firm. I mean, the whole thing rolls out as when I was a musician in Riverside, I got asked to edit a rock magazine. And I didn't know anything about that, but I read them. So I go, well, I can do that. So we had this fanzine. And when I moved to Hollywood, I was looking for work. I saw this thing called Music Connection. And it just said Music Connection. I called them up. What do you guys do? Oh, we're a magazine. I go, oh, I know how to do that. So I went in and showed them my magazine. They go, okay, you're hired. And so I started writing for them. Anyways, I ended up being a pretty prolific magazine writer for industry and mm-hmm. rock fan type magazines.
They still do.
And I flipped that at one point to make more money to become a publicist. So I was a reasonably successful publicist. And towards the end of that thing, one thing I sort of specialized on was working with independent labels that didn't have in-house publicity, of which Triple X was one. I got frustrated with the company, so I actually went to them. I go, pay me what you pay the company to have me do your work, and I'll just come to your office and do it on your machine. You'll have a publicist. They go, well, that's an incredible idea, and so that's how it started. And, you know, all the companies I've worked for, since then, it's been Triple X and Knitting Factory, are... I won't say mom and pops because Knitting Factory is definitely a corporation, but definitely very tightly honed, and just about everybody involved does more than one thing. I do more stuff than manage bands.
Yep.
And
that's why I said you're like kind of a hyphen.
Yeah, you know, so while I was at the label, I was in charge of publicity, but that sort of, you know, rolled into booking the advertisements everywhere. And then eventually I would sign some bands, and then I would become the product manager on that.
What was the staff there? How many people worked?
Let me do a little quick, but probably about six of us at most of the time.
It's pretty small.
It would get bigger and smaller depending on where we were in the history of it all.
Does the label still exist? Or?
You know, the guy who runs it is still in the music business, who ran it. His name is Peter Heuer. He does the business for Alive Records, which is part of the Bomp world.
Mm-hmm. With an exclamation point, right?
Yes. Yeah. And so he still licenses titles and stuff, but the label itself is not active.
Well, rest in peace to that label. So how did you transition to the Knitting Factory entity?
Well, so I was still at Triple X, and the Knitting Factory had opened here in Hollywood. It was right by my house, so I went.
Was
to
it the same
times.
Place that I had
yeah,
played?
Yeah, okay. that was the only facility ever in Hollywood named Knitting Factory. And a friend of mine, I was looking for some new DJ work. The place I had been DJing had gone under. And a friend said, oh, you need to see Liz over at the Knitting Factory. They're hiring DJs. And I'd known Liz from Restless Records, where she was sort of the me of Restless Records when I was at Triple X. So I hit her up and started DJing there about once or twice a week, and kind of was part
after
of the
after shows got out, or how did that
work? It's sort
of
in between. At the time, you know, if you remember that middle stage.
Mm-hmm. The front room.
Yes, in the beginning, that was a restaurant and kind of a lounge area. They didn't have shows in there. So we had a DJ booth in there, and that would be sort of where you would go chill in between the two rooms, and I would kind of play sort of something that kind of mixed with whatever both shows were.
Right. Sometimes they had three shows going on at once.
Well, that would be after they changed that room into a full stage and took the restaurant out.
I liked the front room. That was actually my favorite.
You know, it was fun. I was actually kind of in charge of putting it together, and it was somewhat of a challenge because, unlike the other two rooms, it was not built with acoustics in mind. So to make it sound good in there was a big hassle, and they wanted to do it for as low budget as possible. And I mean, it was done nicely, but to make it sound good. And they also wanted to have, when they first opened it, the idea was we have live music in the two rooms, and then in this room we're going to do like dance club stuff. And it just didn't work because we were on Hollywood Boulevard, and there was a million, you know, burgeoning dance clubs that were already smashing up that market. So we eventually turned it into a live band room as well.
I've seen so many shows there. Well, I saw so many shows there.
Well, it was a cool place because it had a 300 cap, so it was a nice little sweet spot for the better local bands and some of the upcoming touring bands.
I saw Paramore open for the Rocket Summer there.
Yeah, they played our big room too.
Yeah, they did. They played my old band, The City Drive, played with this band called The Matches. That was doing really well at the time, and we sold out. Was the big room, was that 300 or was that like 450?
No, that was 500.
Yeah, so I thought, we sold out that room. That was probably one of my favorite shows I've ever played. And the New York Knitting Factory was in the best location. And now it's in Williamsburg, which is the cooler location now, but I remember. But isn't there one in, is it Spokane? Or?
There's one in Spokane. There's one in Boise. There was one in Reno. We closed that down. But we've sort of moved into doing is booking different rooms that are not Knitting Factories, but we take over the booking and production.
It's like talent buying for these venues.
So that's been something that's been very successful for us.
Has that been? Does that correlate with the management company, or is that just a separate?
It's pretty separate. Yeah.
Well, I mean, because what I wrote down is number four on the sheet was knit, venue, label, and management. So we could skip label for a minute. Let's talk about management, because that's something that we quote unquote know a little bit about. Mm-hmm. You manage, I believe, five bands on.
There's six total. I haven't announced them all. There's some that are still like kind of bubbling.
And I thought I did my research.
No. You wouldn't have known. It wasn't on the.
Dang it. Well, so how did that work? Because obviously, if you've been behind the scenes and you've played in bands, you have a different voice to bring to these bands that other people wouldn't. I guess people who aren't as well versed. So how did that come about?
Well, it came about when the venue was closing. We all had pretty fair amount of time to know that the venue was closing. And there was, there was talk that we're going to relocate, which we eventually did to the Federal, but it's such a different animal.
Which has great food, by the way. Hashtag
thank you,
awesome.
Thank you. So I, I, uh, I didn't really see that there was going to be a home for me in the company. So I was looking around for work and had some things lined up.
This was when, like, 2000?
This was 2009.
Yeah.
With the actual last show we had was a Halloween show with Hit the Lights. In the main stage in Crematorium, which was one of our sound guys and Tex led the band. They were in the medium room. I don't remember who was in the small room. I DJ'd that last show. It was pretty fun. But that was the wrap-up point. So I had to come up with something to do to make bread. And at the time, the CEO of the company had the concept of, you know, we see all these young bands coming through. Some of them are great. Why don't we manage some of them that are kind of, you know, in need of a boost? So we did. He signed a couple singer-songwriters, and I was having lunch with him as we were winding down. I go, okay, so you're managing these kids, but, you know, you're the CEO of a corporation. How do you have time to deal with just, you know, the nuts and bolts day-to-day
can
jump?
Can you help me change a light bulb?
And he goes, I haven't really thought of it. And I go, well, I can do it. It's not that much different than what I did at the record label or, you know, even producing shows here. So there you go. So I started taking care of them.
What year was
that?
This
would have been pretty much as we were wrapping up. And at the same time, I started handling different promotional aspects of the Brooklyn Club, which hadn't opened, which was just opening, mm-hmm. and of the Reno Club as it was gearing up. So I did all that simultaneously while we were building the LA end of the management office. They also, at the time, took part in a company called Figure Eight Management, which had a lot of pretty big acts, still does. And since then, they have merged with us. So Knitting Factory Management is now what used to be Figure Eight and the stuff we've built up.
Who's
in
LA. On Figure Eight?
Jose Gonzalez, Chick Chick Chick, Flock of Dimes, some pretty good stuff. They have, whoops, sorry about that.
They just broke their room.
In New York, I think they handle 13 bands, and there's maybe more like 12, and there's some that are handled up in a auxiliary office we have in San Francisco. And we handle about 8 here in L.A. I think it might be over 20 now. I think we're up to about 22.
That's a lot.
We also just picked up a new gentleman, and he handles Lee Fields, who's playing Coachella this weekend.
Are you going?
I am not. I'm not a huge fan of the gigantic mega festival. It's just musically.
Well, that captures it to a T there.
You know, it's too all over the place for me. Even if you get, like, you know, kind of the VIP treatment, it's just too much stuff I'm not that interested in seeing while being stuck in the middle of the desert.
It's not my scene. I still want to go at some point, but just the tickets, unless you're affiliated with a band or something, are just so outrageous. And my wife and I, we were discussing, because she is off for Easter Monday for some reason. So she's like, why don't we go to Palm Springs this weekend? I said, are you freaking nuts?
Yeah, if you're not in the
know. Do you want to drive traffic just to stay in our hotel, which is going to be filled with all these spring break kids? You don't want that.
No. Well, we just went just this last weekend. I mean, I kind of like smaller, more focused festivals, and we just went to Desert Generator mm-hmm. out in Pioneer Town. By Joshua Tree, and that was a blast. It was just 5 bands and
29 palms.
Kind of near there. And it was a van, custom van show, 5 heavy rock bands, you know, at Pappy and Harriet's outside. It was very fun.
That's awesome. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to get into, I guess, the actual label, Knitting Factory Records, and stick around. Stay tuned. You're going to learn a lot. Hello, welcome back to Waldman's Words with Bruce Duff, who's having a ton of fun. So, Knitting Factory Records, let's touch on that a little bit. I know that you're not as affiliated with that as you are with the management sector, but I still want to hear about it.
Well, the office is in New York, so it really grew out of the New York Club back in the day when Michael Dorff ran it, and it was sort of an outlet for kind of the more avant-garde jazz stuff that they specialized in as a venue. And from that time, Michael left the company, and one of the guys that's really behind it in terms of financing, his favorite music of all time is Fela Kuti. So we acquired the Fela catalog, and the label focus sort of shifted to world beat as opposed to skronky jazz.
What
to
is
a degree.
Skronky?
You know, kind of like...
I've never heard that word.
You know, that just sort of outside, very avant-garde, James Blood, Ulmer type of New York jazz. It was very underground, but pretty popular during the 80s. That was always kind of a specialty for the label. And now it's definitely more world beat. But there wasn't much infrastructure for the label, so what we did was we acquired a percentage of Partisan Records, which is a Brooklyn label that specialized in a lot of underground rock. Particularly, their biggest act was Deer Tick, which a friend of mine...
I've heard of Deer Tick.
Yeah, they sort of labeled it urban hipster. So it's kind of... It's
pre-modern hipster.
Yeah, no, it's very bearded, independent rock type stuff,
that's
but with an Americana leaning.
Okay.
But they've, as every label will, they've branched out a lot from that too. They do a lot of psychedelic stuff like Witches. It's a pretty cool label. So Partisan, we took a portion of them, but they in turn began running the Knitting Factory Records. So their whole infrastructure runs both labels.
Okay.
So
and in your federal office, there's no label operations there.
No,
right?
No. They've got it all down in Brooklyn.
In Williamsburg, right by the venue?
Pretty much, yeah. They know what they're doing.
It seems like
And the Figure Eight management company shares an office with them.
Got it. Yeah, no, your office was cool. I mean, I'm going to give another shout-out to the Federal because the food there was freaking awesome. And Knitting Factory took care of Scott Waldman, who's now talking third person.
You know, it's a funny thing. As the company has evolved, and I've seen it up close and personal, it's like been one of the more interesting growths of any music company I've ever witnessed. And when I started, I guess this is kind of an interesting little side note. When I started there
as a DJ, please, side notes and stories.
The guy who was in charge of the bar staff, who was the bar manager, is today the CEO of the company.
What?
So that's kind of an interesting
that's growth.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's done a great job. But coming from the more bar hospitality end of things, as opposed to the label. Venue promotion production end of things, one of the main things he did as CEO, this is a Morgan Margolis I'm shouting out to.
What's up,
MM? Said we need to do more hospitality, and so he was the one that actually instigated opening the Federal and then opening more restaurants.
You know Cornell has the number one hotel and hospitality program? Just FYI.
I did not know that.
See, you learned something new
on
the show. And MM might not know that either.
Yes. Well, he probably does. So then, you know, that became a very successful part of our company, and then we opened another Federal in Long Beach, which has a rock venue in it as well, the Federal Underground. Which
it's a small cap, right?
It's 300. It's
in
the
big.
Bald. It's a really cool room. I would say, along with Alex's, it's the room to play down there.
Long Beach is becoming really hip lately with Music Tastes Good and a lot of, obviously Sublime's from that area, but it's definitely up and coming.
Yeah,
and
we're also involved with booking the big New Year's Eve thing they've been doing, I think.
Is it an outdoor thing?
Yeah, it's actually where the Federal is on Pine, but it's the whole street for like a few blocks, and there's two big stages. And
food trucks, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a to-do. And, you know, the restaurant, there's a lot of restaurants right along that strip, so they all open up with specials and stuff. It's pretty fun. We went there. We had a bunch of our bands on, I think, 2 years ago. Fitz and the Tantrums headline.
Oh, wow.
And it was a great night.
I hear in Fitz and the Tantrums, I hear so much Hall & Oates in their music.
There's definitely a lot of Philly soul in it. And, you know, the whole approach with no guitar.
Yep.
It's kind of interesting.
And backing vocals.
Yeah, make the keyboard player the heart of it.
The heart, like they say, the heart of rock and roll is in Cleveland. All right, anyway. So I guess the next transition is let's hear about The Smell of Death, because you are an author. In fact, I can go on Amazon right now and purchase a book.
Yes,
hashtag promotion.
The short story of it is I was on a tour in 92, and we went through we went through 11 countries in Europe in 9 weeks. So quite a bit of traveling. It was an insane tour. I was with Jeff Dahl, who I'd been played with during the 80s, and he was going to tour while I was still working at the label, and he was going to go, he was on Triple X, and he was going to go tour Europe, and his bass player couldn't do it, so we put together a band from Hollywood, and he came out here and rehearsed 2 days, and we went on a 9 week tour. He was from here.
Okay.
I mean, he grew up in D.C., but he had his band Power Trip, and then the Jeff Dahl group were here in Hollywood. And then he eventually moved to Phoenix for many years. He was living in Phoenix at this time. He lives in Hawaii now. So anyways, we did this tour. It was quite an adventure. I took a ton of photos, and we had this big tour diary that would tell you where you're going to be, with everything was spelled correctly and all the addresses and everything all through the tour. And I took, during these long, boring van rides every day, I took the time to write what happened the night before on that page. So, you know, we all got home, and everybody's girlfriend left them, and everybody's life, we were all broke, and it was somewhat depressing, and I had nothing to do, you know, living by myself in this apartment. So I just started, you know, I kind of got reminiscent about this tour, and I looked at this tour diary and looked at all my photos I'd developed, and I go, there might be a book in this. So I typed it out and started shopping it around, and some friends of mine that had been, because I was in, you know, kind of the journalism world at the same time, some friends had hooked me up with big book publishers and went to visit a lot of them and take the book around, which was all done. And they go, well, this is a pretty cool book, but no one's going to buy it. No one knows who Jeff Dahl is and who you are, and no one cares. So I heard this enough
times. That's so nice to hear.
Well, I mean, they said it more politely than that, but that's what it meant. And I'd heard this enough times that I just...
The L.A.?
Yeah, it's great.
I just threw it in a corner and forgot about it. And roll the clock many years forward till after I was married a second time and at the Knitting Factory and doing all kinds of
You're
different
married
stuff.
At the Knitting Factory?
Not exactly, but during that time. And my wife is the, she is the announcer, among other things she does, for the L.A. Derby Dolls. And one of the girls at the Derby Dolls was the number two person at Rare Bird Publishing.
Get out of town.
And my wife slipped her the manuscript without me even knowing about it, and they contacted me and said, we'd like to publish this. So,
fist pound.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's like a 22-year lag time between writing and publishing.
I mean, that's really a smell of death.
Yeah, so I think to them, they actually looked at it as a look back at what was going on in the trenches in the 90s.
Well, in the literal trenches, admittedly, after you sent me a list, I did not read the entire book, but I heard that there's some mentions of things that smell bad in that book. So
Chapter one was, just to kind of kick it off as violently as possible,
please,
is the tale of a story not in Europe. It was a run up the coast that Jeff Dahl Band did, and we opened for the legendary Gigi Allen, and it was quite a story.
Gigi Allen, for those who don't know, has littered stages with blood and feces and is a very violent performer of such hits as I Want to Fuck Myself.
Yeah, well, and seeing his pre-concert prep was an eye-opener.
Did it involve heroin?
No, no. What it involved was, he toured Chuck Berry style, so he rolled in on a bus with nothing in his little knapsack. And there was a band, some local punk band, waiting there that had diligently learned his songs.
Oh, so it's Chuck Berry. That's what Chuck does? He has hired guns in every
for
city?
For decades.
Oh, I didn't know
he
that.
He didn't tour with a band, I don't think, since the 60s.
Is that because he was fucking nuts?
No, he just, you know, he figured it's Chuck Berry. If you're in a band and you don't know all my songs, you must suck. So he just figured, you know, everyone would know what to do. You know, even Bruce Springsteen's band opened for, was Chuck Berry's backing band at some point.
Oh, wow. That'd be cool to see.
But so anyways, this band sound checked with them and it was great. So they launched into a song and they were in at about a verse and, you know, Gigi started doing some spaz thing and like rolling on the stage and just kind of freaking out in soundcheck. And the band just sort of go, whoa, what's this? And they stopped. He goes, no. No matter what happens, doesn't matter, whatever I do, you keep playing the song as if I'm singing. So that was just sort of a test drive to clue them into that. Then he went out and got...
Ever the showman.
Yes. He went out and got a couple big burgers and ate the burgers and then drank... Are you ready? He drank a bottle of Crisco to ensure that he would be able to perform the fecal deed during the set. It
just so you know, there's a fecal deed during the set.
And then he would throw up. I mean, the whole thing was just disgusting. And like the club was hip enough...
You can't see my face right now, but...
The club was hip enough to cover the entire back line with sliced open a plastic trash bag so that none of their stuff got defiled, as it were. But then our favorite part was backstage after all this. He was making out with some girl from the audience that looked like Marianne Faithfull. And I was
post-poop.
Just like, you know, it's a wonderful world we live in.
Well, it's crazy as I was actually just in Orange County. There was a Sabroso festival with The Offspring, with Lit, Sum 41, and they had Kobayashi there. who's the hot dog champion, the guy who wins all those Nathan hot dog eating contests.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
And they had a Chronic Tacos eating contest on stage with like 10 different people, including Kobayashi, who ate 159 tacos in 10 minutes. I digress. But there was puke. There was stuff everywhere. And I just felt bad because, like, Sum 41 opened up for the taco eating contest. So anyway.
That might be better than playing after the taco.
Well, that was Offspring. Yeah, that the remnants of that must have been crazy. But the singer of the Offspring, actually, Gringo Bandito, the sauce, he owns it. So it just works out.
Did not know that.
Yeah, see, you learn.
Two things
say,
now.
Just two?
I would try out Gringo Bandito myself.
I've learned three things from you. We would love it if Gringo Bandito would sponsor this show. So speaking of shows, let's hear about Tone Duff. You do so much. I don't know when you
sleep.
Well,
that's actually related to the book.
What?
Because
your publisher.
As nice as my publisher is, I'm afraid the early publishers were correct, and it was not a bestseller. It did okay, but we haven't recouped yet in very indie rock terms. So, he's like, how can we sell more of these books? I go, I don't know, maybe take out an ad in a book that leans towards people that might be interested in, you know, 90s punk rock. But now, how about if you start doing podcasts on our radio channel? I'm like, what? Well, let me check that out. So they have a lot of podcasts where authors talk to other authors and things like that. And I thought they were fine and dandy, and they hooked me up with a Skype system and all that. And I was listening to them, and I was like, you know, the problem I have with these is they don't sound very good. I have a recording studio on, and I have people come over here. We'll record it nicely, and and then I'll edit it. And
why do you think I come to this studio to do these podcasts?
I mean, it definitely makes a big difference. So anytime someone's through town or someone I'm interested in, I've cut 18 of them, 17 are out. And it's usually with an author or a musician who's written a book or somebody who's written a book about music. And sometimes I get off that a little bit if it's something I'm interested in. Latest guest was Anna Biller, who was the director of The Love Witch. I don't know if you saw that movie, but amazing. And she is quite a talent. She wrote, directed, scored, costume designed, and set designed the movie. It took her 7 years. She's a control freak at a level that I could never hope to attain, and an amazing talent.
Any favorite rock bios or autobiographies, or not necessarily rock, because there's so many great ones.
Well, because of this, I've had to read a lot of stuff. Some of it's been pretty amazing. There was a book called The Punk Elegies by Alan McDonald, which is also on Rare Bird, which I wouldn't have come across otherwise. I really, really enjoyed that book.
I read Please Kill Me. That was a good
one. That's a good one. And a book that's they don't like being compared to it, but one of the books we just covered was called New York Rock by Stephen Blush, and Tony Mann, his editor, came on with him. An incredible, almost encyclopedia of the history of New York rock.
From when?
Well, sort of starting with in depth with the Velvet Underground, but really rolling all the way back to Tin Pan Alley and the Brill Building. And even
everything I learned about Nico I don't like.
Interesting, yeah. I'm a big fan, but yeah, it seems like a difficult person.
Yeah, I just read a whole bunch of stuff, and since my last name is Waldman, I think you can assume why I might not like her. But Lou Reed, he's a Long Island boy who, I mean, recently passed, but he's quite a storied career.
Yeah, there's a lot of him in the book. It rolls all the way forward to they sort of cap it when Seabees.
Okay,
closed.
So they talk about the Ramones, they talk about the Dolls.
Oh, it goes all the way through, like, the New York noise stuff of Sonic Youth mm-hmm. and Honeymoon Killers. It's a thorough book to a level where there's so much stuff I learned. And, nowadays where you can go on Spotify and see if stuff is on there, and, 80% of the time it is. There's
it's
really
amazing.
A lot of music you can dig up and learn about from,
like, right now I could click on something. It's stupid.
You could say it hurt the industry, and in some ways of course it has, but I love it. Mm-hmm. I love being able to just listen to anything at my fingertips as soon as I learn about it.
No, it's unbelievable. I'm floored by the fact that I can literally make myself a mix or a playlist for someone right now and they'll freak out. So we don't have too much time left. I guess if you want to touch upon this, you're also a record producer.
Yeah, to some degree.
To a bigger degree than I am.
Yeah. Yes. I've produced actually quite a lot of records. sometimes in partnership with my pal Frank Meyer, who we play with in the Streetwalk and Cheetahs. We do our own records. We produce stuff by Thor, Prima Donna.
Two Tens, right?
No, Two Tens I did on my own.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I did not do that with Frank. And actually, the new record is about three quarters produced by me, and they did three songs with John Fields, who's big time.
Very big.
In Minneapolis, and we actually got him to mix the record.
Oh, wow.
And it's we're actually on the very last steps of mixing as I speak. It'll be done by the end of the week, and then we head off to the mastering lab.
That's awesome.
We're really happy with it.
Well, you should be. I guess let's close this out. Do you have any advice for someone who wants to break into the industry, be it work at a label, work at a venue, management, or anything?
You know, the big deal is make yourself available. You know, go to shows that you like, meet people, have, you know, be friendly. Just the more people you know, the more connections you have. And one piece of advice I always give to musicians, people ask about what should we know, and I always tell them, you know, as unpleasant as it is, learn how to read a contract. You know, don't just hand it to someone to tell you what it means and what you should ask for. Read it yourself and ask specific questions. What does this clause mean? What does that clause mean? And understand it. It'll help you in the long run.
Of course it would. I mean, I worked at a law firm, actually. I'm not a lawyer, as I've said many times, but I worked at a law firm for 5 years before starting the management company, and I can tell you how much that helped me with everything, because you're only as good as the paper you sign.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one thing I will say that I think musicians get, especially because contracts are written to intimidate.
Yep.
That's a definite thing. They want you to be uncomfortable with them. And I think you got to remember that if you're being handed a contract, somebody wants to work with you. So you can ask.
Somebody wants to earn money from you.
Of course. And they think you'll make that money. So you can ask for stuff. You know, you might not get it, but definitely ask, because they want you to.
Look at Van Halen's tour riders.
Yep, there you go. Well, that's yeah. Sure.
You could ask for. You could try. It's worth a go. I mean, that's why the word negotiation comes into it. Well, we're almost done. So thank you so much for coming
out,
Bruce.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, no. Immediately after meeting you, I knew you'd be a good guest for this. As I said in the beginning, we've got Mark and Eric from Word is Bond Management on next week. We've got Dan Suroff, who manages Black Veil Brides, on the following week. We've got Blake Cordero, manager for Nominee and works at Catalyst Publicity. And we've got Morgan Carney at the venue Rockettown and manages several bands, including Woven and Hiatus, Radner, Forever at Last. So I guess we have about a minute. Do you have any stories you want to cap this out with?
Any stories I want to cap this
out? It doesn't have to involve poop or Gigi.
You know, I don't. When does this air?
This airs on Tuesday. So
well, then if you're in the Southern California area,
this is a good story.
Come to it's a hike. Come down to Sunday, last Sunday of the month. Come down to the Rainbow in the Roxy Theater. There's a Rainbow anniversary show.
And the Lemmy show?
No, they do it every year. It's last weekend of April. Or second to last, whatever that is.
Second to last is the Sunday is the 23rd.
That's it.
Okay,
and come on down, and Streetwalk and Cheetahs are playing. We are pretty hard driving MC5 punk rock band, but we're playing with Quiet Riot and Jet Boy, and it'll be hilarious.
Wait, at the Rainbow?
It's not at. It's in the park. They turn the whole parking lot behind the Roxy into a stage. Swing House does the sounds. Very high production.
Swing House is awesome.
And I went last year, and it was another unusual billing. It was. Buck Cherry and Iron Butterfly. So
what?
I mean,
in a Gata De Vida, yeah. I want the cocaine.
And we heard all 17 minutes of it, so it'll be wonderful. It's free.
So is it similar vibe to like the Sunset Strip Music Fest
kind of? It's kind of. It's much smaller and it doesn't cost any money.
Well,
and you get to drink at the Rainbow.
And you get to have their pizza and try to wear Saran Wrap when you walk in the Rainbow, because that is an STD factory.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I'm sorry. All right, anyway, we're going to close out with offending our guests. Thank you so much for coming here.
Thanks a lot, guys.
And just stick around for all things Waldman's Words. Shout out to Gone Fishkin. Have a good day.